my next guest took her willingness to having a successful career to new levels. As she climbed the corporate ladder, systemic racism raised its ugly head and attempted to stop her in her tracks several times. After suffering from racial trauma and contemplating ending her own life, she listened to that divine voice and made her exit from corporate America for good. She decided to tell her story and the story of many others through a work of fiction that has garnered attention from all over the world. Coming up next on the 40 Plus Files, international best-selling and award-winning author and speaker, Jackie Abram.
Women over 40, the 40 Plus Files, the 40 Plus Files.
Welcome to the show, Jackie. How are you?
I am well. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to have you on. So we have so much to talk about. But before we get into all of that, I'll ask you a question that I ask all of my guests on the show. How did you view aging when you were in your 20s?
So when I was in my 20s, I saw aging as something I absolutely did not want to do. I remember talking to my mother and, you know, telling her as her hair was starting to change more from, you know, black to silver and gray that, you know, I was going to fight it tooth and nail. And she would say things like, you know, the salt and pepper look is in. And I would say, if you're a man, not if you're a woman. So that kind of gives you an idea of where my thoughts were in terms of aging at that age.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, you know, women in their 20s, people in general think mm-hmm. that, you know, 40, 50 years old is just ancient and they just cannot imagine.
Right. You hear the phrases, well, back in your day. And I'm like, when exactly do you think my day was?
Yes, right. A horse and carriage.
Right?
Yes. So since the show is called The 40 Plus Files, what was your biggest epiphany after turning 40 or 50? Because you are a part of the 50 Plus Club, as am I. Absolutely. So did you have any epiphanies?
So let me just start off by saying that I will be 55 on New Year's Eve.
Wow.
And you know, there's a few things that happened, you know, from the journey from 20 to 50. Some of the things that happened, which resulted in those epiphanies, was the fact that, you know, my body, my hormones, everything started changing. Mm-hmm. And so there were things that, you know, maybe I wouldn't have thought I would do, but I was forced to do because, you know, you just really had no choice. So let me give you an example of that. Mm-hmm. Over the years, I developed an allergy to hair color. And so you may not want to go gray. You may not desire to go gray. But if you can't color that gray, guess what? You're going to go gray.
Yeah.
And here's the interesting thing, though. Gray hair on melanin skin is absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one epiphany that I had. It was like, you know, ooh, gray, silver. There's another color that they call platinum, I think is what it's called. Mm-hmm. Just beautiful on brown skin. So that was one epiphany. But the other epiphany that I had was that, you know, I actually enjoyed the aging process because I was actually wiser. There were things that I would not do or accept at this age that at 20, I thought was the norm. You know, so I appreciated that growth, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense. Being able to appreciate that, you know, taking all of our experiences and learning from them. Right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes. What did your life or career path look like after you graduated from high school? Let's take it back there.
So let me just tell you, high school wise, I had a completely different idea of who I thought I was going to be career wise.
Okay.
So let me just take you back to that point at in high school, right out of high school. I was a 6 foot tall Janet Jackson lookalike. Mm. I was confident. You know, I had a walk, I'm going to just tell you, that could stop traffic. Okay. And so my thoughts were, you know, well, I've got the making of a runway model, and this is what I'm going to do. But it's interesting how your career path changes when you put on 100 pounds mm-hmm. and you have children. And so now all of the sudden, what you thought you were going to be is not at all what you are going to be. And so I found that I would have to rely on something else, which was my intellect. Mm-hmm. And so I went into the higher education field. My career spanned nearly 20 years. And that was going to be my career path. And it would still be my career path if something else didn't get in the way. And that would have been racism in the workplace. And so, you know, when I was younger, I really didn't know a whole lot about racism mm-hmm. because I grew up in an environment, it was an impoverished environment where, you know, everyone in that community looks like you. Mm-hmm. So you're really not exposed to real racism. It wasn't until after I graduated high school and I began my career in corporate America mm-hmm. that I discovered, you know, what racism truly looks and feels and smells like. Mm-hmm. And that is what ultimately ended my 20-year career in higher education and put me on the path that I'm on now, which is an international best-selling and award-winning author.
Yes, absolutely. And we'll talk a lot about your book in just a moment. But you also talk about being raised by a single mother. And then raising your daughters in much of the same way. What were some of the key values that you appreciated from your mother that you instilled in your own daughters?
Well, you know, my mother was an absolutely phenomenal woman, just full of beauty and courage and strength and grace. Mm-hmm. She was the type of woman who could make something out of absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, we grew up poor. And so beyond just being able to provide for us at a time where there was, you know, little to nothing to give, it was interesting to me watching my mother because she was always grateful to God for every little bit that we had. And so that was something that I was able to watch in her and to see how, even when she was at her lowest point, and, mm-hmm. you know, me and my sister were stealing dog biscuits from the neighbor to eat because there was no food, my mom was still grateful. And she thanked God even during those very difficult times. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the values that I instilled in my girls, was that, you know, no matter how difficult the road and the path that you're on may seem, God is in control. He's aware of what you're going through. And if there's anything that you want to know, he always shows up right on time. Mm-hmm. So you may not like those dog biscuits that you're eating, but at least you're eating.
Hmm. Wow. Okay. Those are, you know, quite some values that you gained from your mom. I'm pretty sure your daughters can appreciate that as well.
Absolutely.
Wow. So talk about the first time you experienced racism on a job. Because again, we're going to get into the book, you know, that's going to be the meat of our conversation. But I want to know, you know, because I can recall, you know, maybe in my teens experiencing some type of racism. And we'll talk about the difference between overt and covert racism. But when did you first experience racism on a job?
So let me just tell you a little bit about my background. When I entered into higher education, mm-hmm. it was at a period of time where, you know, this is brand new to me. I am living in poverty right now. I want to do something to pull myself and my family out of poverty. Mm-hmm. I've been told that there is something called the American dream that anyone, you know, can achieve if they work hard and they get the education and they have those credentials. But because I lived in poverty, college was never something that I ever considered was an option for me. And then God found a way to put me into a college system. So right out of high school, you know, I enter into this college system and things are great in the beginning. And what was interesting was, you know, I had been working a lot of dead-end jobs before that.
Okay.
And I didn't experience racism because I think, you know, looking back, as long as you are operating in an area that racists think you belong,
wow,
you are kind of safe. But when you start reaching for something higher than what they think you are entitled to, mm-hmm. that's when you encounter problems. So for me, once I got into this college system, mm-hmm. That also came with tuition reimbursement. So now the opportunity to get a degree is within my grasp. And I'm good at what I do because I've made sure that whatever they give me, I'm going to not only do it to the best of my ability, but I'm going to research what other people have done. And I'm going to make sure that I'm performing at an excellent level. So when you are ambitious, mm-hmm. when you are excellent at what you do, and let's not forget, I was a 6 foot tall Janet Jackson lookalike. Hmm. And so I've got confidence as well. Mm-hmm. Oh, racists don't like that very much. Hmm. So they started attacking me and trying to literally break my spirit, break me like I was a wild horse. They were determined and eager to tame. And there were a combination of things, Jacqueline. I mean, there were small things that, yes, they're annoying. Yes, mm-hmm. they hurt. Yes, they bother you, but they don't kill your careers. And then you get the bigger career killing things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of those small things were like nitpicking, mm-hmm. you know, that can't be your real hair. It's too shiny. Mm. Okay. Or, you know, we're not comfortable with you wearing those high heels because you're already taller than everybody here. So we need you to either wear flats or wear a lower heel. Two things like, you know, your clothes are not appropriate for our environment. And, you know, if I say, well, my clothes conform to the dress code, they're too fitted. They're too voluptuous. So we need you to change the way you dress if you want to succeed in this environment. You know, we're just telling you that because we have your best interest at heart. Mm. So those little nitpicky things to the bigger things. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now you have a leader in the organization who has noticed you because you're excellent at your job. Mm-hmm. You're ambitious, but you're also, you know, what they may consider attractive. And so this leader does not think that you deserve that position that you hold. Mm-hmm. And so because of their power and influence, they are able to inspire others in the organization to conspire with them. Mm-hmm. They are offering rewards to your team to sabotage you. They are inspiring HR to work with them because after all, they are the ones paying HR's paycheck. And so you're working with a team of people who are all working together to set you up, mm-hmm. derail your career, and ultimately get you out of their door.
Mm-hmm. I know that's just the tip of the iceberg, right? So today, and I know that you talk about your experiences in this book, but so many companies now have diversity, equity, and inclusion trainings and departments, right? When did you understand that systemic racism was just a real problem in the workplace, and not just something that's fly by night that happens every so often to, you know, one or two of us?
So early on in my career, when you get targeted, okay, and let me just go a little deeper into what targeting looks like. Mm-hmm. When you are targeted by a leader in the organization, like I said, that has power and influence, mm-hmm. it actually looks a lot like what happened, sadly and just horrifically, to George Floyd. Where, you know, if you recall the situation, he was murdered, brutally yes. killed mm-hmm. by a racist police officer, Derek Chauvin. Mm-hmm. Okay. But if you remember, when Derek took his last breath from him, mm-hmm. he was not alone. He had help. There were three other officers on that scene with him. Mm-hmm. Okay. There was one officer who was holding down George's legs. Okay. Mm-hmm. He's got his body weight on him, holding down his legs. Right. You have another officer who's got his knee in George's back. So he's got his body weight on him. Okay. Mm-hmm. You have another officer who is standing as a barrier. He's created a wall mm-hmm. between the police officer who's in the act of killing him and the people standing on the sidewalk who see what's happening. They know it's wrong. They want it to stop, but they're afraid of the authority that this person who's created this barrier mm-hmm. has, as well as the other officers. So they scream, they holler, they beg, mm-hmm. but ultimately no one intervenes because they're afraid. Mm. And then finally, you have Derek Chauvin, who's got his knee on George's neck. Yeah. So you have a total of 1, 2, 3 police officers, all with their body weight on this man, rendering him powerless and helpless to defend himself as they work together and kill him. Now, the reason I bring this up is because of all of the police officers who were on the scene that day, Derek Chauvin was the leader. He was the most senior officer with the power and the influence. So when he led, the rest of them followed and they aided and abetted him as he killed George in his community. Mm-hmm. So if you take that scenario where they kill us in our community, mm-hmm. and you move it on over here to the workplace, you are a Black person. You are good at your job. You may have some microaggressions going on over here. You know, somebody doesn't like your hair. You know, somebody doesn't like your clothes, mm-hmm. but that's not what kills your career. Okay. Mm-hmm. What kills your career is the leader. Maybe he wasn't there when you started, mm-hmm. but he's there now and he's noticed you and he targets you. Well, he may be the one carrying out the act of killing your career, just like Derek Chauvin did, but he's never alone. He mm-hmm. always has help. He inspires others, like I said, to conspire with him. One of those people inspired to conspire works in HR. He's got other people, some people on your team, some people in other departments, and they're all working together. They are making your job more difficult by withholding information that you need to do your job. Mm-hmm. They are giving you a workload that is so heavy, your back is about to break or you fall to your knees. Mm-hmm. This is why you see a lot of Black folks working, you know, 70, 80 hours a right. week to do their job, working mm-hmm. on the weekends, working at night, working through their lunches, working on holidays, because they are expected to carry a workload that no human can carry, because this organization sees you as not human, mm-hmm. but a Black workhorse that they are going to ride and drive until you can't take it. Mm. And because of the overloaded workload, You're making mistakes, which they are documenting and watching. You are under unfair scrutiny. So while you, the people around you can make mistakes, you are held to excellence. You must be excellent. You have no option to be excellent, because if you make a mistake, they're using it against you. Mm-hmm. And so you've got all of these obstacles that are being put in your way. And remember those people on the sidewalk that were watching in horror, mm-hmm. but they were afraid to intervene? You have people in that organization who are watching you go through this, mm-hmm. who are seeing what's happening to you. Some of those people are Black, mm-hmm. and they're afraid of what might happen if they try to intervene or get involved. So they see it, but they won't come to your aid. So you are isolated. You are alone. As you are traumatized, you're experiencing psychological damage. You're experiencing physical and emotional distress. Mm-hmm. And by the time this company is done with you, mm-hmm. you are broken. And this once smart, confident person is a shadow of who you are.
Mm-hmm. That is such a powerful analogy, the whole George Floyd scene. Yes. And just to compare it to racism in corporate America, that is just powerful, Jackie. I've never heard such a powerful analogy.
They kill our careers in the workplace the mm-hmm. same way they kill us in our community. Both mm-hmm. scenarios end in different types of death. Mm-hmm. One is permanent, but the other one you repeat over and over again. Because if you look at a Black person's resume, mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, it looks like they're job hopping. They're running from job to job to job. Mm. What the person looking at that resume doesn't realize is they're not job hopping. Mm-hmm. They're running because they're Black. They're running from this place to this place. But like I say, you ran from here because you were Black. And mm-hmm. when you ran over here, guess what? You were still Black.
Yeah, still Black. That's right. Yeah. Wow. Now, talk about your book called Hush Money, How One Woman Proved Systemic Racism in Her Workplace and Kept Her Job. Let me just tell you, this book, it's a page turner, number one, but it's so powerful. I love the name of the title of the book. And I mean, every single thing about it. I mean, it's just no wonder that it's an international bestseller. People are talking about it. I mean, people are saying how it changed their lives. There are, you know, white allies who've read this book and said how much it has helped them. Oh my gosh, where do we even start, right? So the book is fiction, but it's based on your life experiences and those of your daughters. So the main character, her name is Ebony. So I want you to start by telling me, how closely related is this character to you or your daughters? Talk about that.
So Hush Money is a book inspired by true events. There is a very real woman behind the character Ebony. Now, if you think about the book and the title, have you ever read a book that, you know, you read the title and you're not sure what you're getting until you actually dive in and you start reading and then you realize, okay, oh, this is what this book is about. Hush Money is not one of those books, okay? You know exactly what you are getting because the title tells you. Hush Money is obviously about hush money. Somebody was paid some hush money, okay? Mm-hmm. The subtitle, How One Woman Proved Systemic Racism in Her Workplace and Kept Her Job, you know, tells you, you know, obviously that, okay, if this woman proved systemic racism and they didn't want her to tell anybody what really happened to her, they paid her some hush money. Mm-hmm. So the woman who inspired this character, you know, she got some hush money, okay? And she got a significant amount, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if you've ever received a settlement, okay? Mm-hmm. If you've mm-hmm. ever received hush money, before they give you that check and let you ride off into the sunset, they're going to give you something else. And that something else is a non-disclosure agreement mm-hmm. or a confidentiality agreement, which prevents you from going out and telling the world what happened to you in their organization, mm-hmm. in their company. But see, one thing that this company didn't count on mm-hmm. was that Ebony was smart. Mm-hmm. And Ebony took their hush money and she signed their agreement. And then she found another way to tell the world what happened to her because she knew that there were a lot of Ebonies all across the world.
Yes.
And she knew that she had something of value mm-hmm. that she could share with them in terms of how she fought back and turned the tables on her oppressors mm-hmm. and did it in such unconventional ways they did not see it coming. So Ebony, you know, even though people have guessed who they think Ebony is, mm-hmm. Ebony never really comes out and says, you know, I'm the real Ebony.
Right.
She could if she wanted to. Mm-hmm. She doesn't. Mm-hmm. But when you dive into the pages of Hush Money, you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that there is a real woman behind this. Because when we wrote Hush Money, you know, I wrote it from a place of pain. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hush Money is not polished. It's written raw. It's written without worrying about where the commas are, worrying about whether the sentences flow. Mm-hmm. It's written very raw because I was at the point in my career, you know, one time, two times, three times, four times, by the fifth time of losing everything that I had worked for, everything that I had built because racists didn't think I deserved the six-figure positions that I held. Mm-hmm. By the fourth and fifth time, I'm so damaged by what keeps happening to me. I contemplated, and take this with all seriousness, mm-hmm. I actually planned to kill my boss because I decided at the end that, you know, I'm done trying. Mm-hmm. I can't make it. And I'm going to take at least one racist with me.
Wow.
So I decided I was literally going to kill my boss. Mm. And, you know, if you just consider that for a minute, that tells you how psychologically damaged I had to be to get to that point. Mm-hmm. And so on the day that, you know, I'm considering this, I'm looking at it from every angle because mm-hmm. I've got an analytical mind.
Yes.
And I just couldn't figure out a way to do it without it impacting my children. Mm-hmm. And so I was a mother before I was anything else. And I said, okay, you know, I can't do this to my girls and have this stigma over them. So instead, I'm going to commit suicide. I'm just going to kill myself.
Wow.
And on the day that I decided to commit suicide, I went to a place called Salt Creek Beach in California. Mm-hmm. I never learned to swim. I still don't know how to swim. And so in my damaged mind, it felt like the appropriate way to do it. So mm-hmm. I'm literally standing on the edge of the ocean, Jacqueline, mm-hmm. and I'm looking out and the call of the sea is strong. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of walking through mesmerized with how I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. Well, God said no. Mm-hmm. And he intervened in the only way that anybody who's been in my position would just stop and rethink. God used my youngest daughter, you know, so mm-hmm. I'm standing on the edge of the ocean. I've got my cell phone in my pocket and it starts ringing. Mm. Pick it up. It's my youngest daughter, Delilah. And she just starts screaming into the phone. She is hysterical. And she's telling me that, you know, she's back home in Colorado. These racists are after her. They're doing the most horrific things to her that you can imagine.
Wow.
She is about to lose her job. And she's a single mom like me. Mm-hmm. And she says, "Mom, I'm not going to make it if you don't come and help me." Now, I don't know about you, but if you've ever had children, if you know anybody that's got children.
Oh, yes.
It's one thing if you mess with me.
Mm-hmm.
But you got a problem on your hands, a big one.
That's right.
You mess with my children.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And it was that call, that intervention that pulled me out of myself. I packed up that day because by this point, I was living in a hotel, having lost everything again.
Mm.
Okay. So I packed up everything. I hopped in my car. I used the last bit of money that I had to drive back to Colorado to help my daughter deal with her situation. And that's when the light bulb came on, because I thought I was going crazy. What drove me to that stage of just being so willing to give up my life was that I thought there was something wrong with me. You know, it didn't occur to me that other people were experiencing what I was going through.
Mm-hmm.
So when God revealed that my daughter was going through the same thing, and then I started asking my oldest daughter questions, and I found out she was going through the same thing on her job.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I've got something I can latch on to. I've got something tangible that I can feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started asking other questions, neighbors, friends, family, strangers. And I found out that a lot of the people, my experiences were their experiences. And so I got with my children and we decided to help all of those Ebonies, you know, who were going through the things that we had gone through.
Mm-hmm.
Because in all the stories, there was one woman who knew how to fight back and not just fight back, you know, survive that battle and win the war.
Yes.
And we decided to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't get a publisher. Mm-hmm. You know, publisher said no one was interested in hearing about racism in the workplace because it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So we self-published.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have marketing background or anything, but we took a chance. And the total investment that we made in this book right here, this book, $22. That's how much we paid to publish this. And $22 was the cost to get someone to design the cover. So that was the investment in what we were able to publish and produce.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And so then we took the books because we self-published on Amazon and we piled those books into the trunk of my car.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just drove around and sold the book at parks and pop-up shops to literally anyone who would hear what we had to say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the thing, though, Jacqueline, and this just blows my mind to this day. 7 months later. I don't know how, only to say, but it was by the grace of God.
Mm-hmm.
7 months later, this book had made it around, I mean, dozens of countries.
Mm.
And it was a number one Amazon bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
It's still number one on Goodreads Listopia for best eye-opening African-American women's fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's still number one for books to improve your social justice awareness on racism in the U.S. It received the gold medal for social issues novels from Reader's Favorite. And people, I mean people, thousands of people from all around the world were contacting me and telling me that, you know, my book was their story. All you had to do was switch the names.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And so my little humble book that, like I said, it's not polished. I don't even know if the commas are in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote it from a place of pain and despair, you know, was changing the lives and empowering so many people, not just people dealing with racism, interestingly enough, but people dealing with all types of discrimination.
Yes.
They were using these strategies to fight back and they were winning.
Yeah. Yes. Now, what I love, and I was just talking about my daughter, I have a 10-year-old daughter, and I was just talking to her about the book and how extremely important it is to document, you know, because this is what Ebony does. Ebony starts keeping a daily log, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, emails, as simple as, you know, as people think they are, I think, you know, we've kind of learned this over the years, but that's a paper trail, right?
You know, Ebony came up with a motto. She said the E in email stands for evidence.
Yes.
And she decided that when she was ready to fight back, she needed to create an arsenal of weapons. Mm-hmm. And so she created these weapons, and one of her most powerful weapons was email. And so let me just kind of tell your audience how she was able to use that.
Yes, please.
Ebony kept a daily log, you know, like you said, and that was equally as important, but email is the golden ticket for fighting racism. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because you want to use email in the good times and the bad times. Mm. So let me just kind of tell you what I mean by that.
Okay.
One of the first things that happens to you when you are targeted, okay, mm-hmm. by a racist leader in an organization, and it's not enough to just nitpick at you. They want you out of their organization. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things that they do is they start painting you as incompetent.
Yes.
Making you out to be the worst employee that they've ever laid eyes on. Mm-hmm. So you have to prepare for that moment because eventually it's going to come. So what you do is Ebony weaponized email. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times they would tell you things verbally. So let's say, for example, we were in a meeting and mm-hmm. Ebony gave a presentation today. After the meeting, you know, several people, you know, they give her kudos. They say, you know, Ebony, great job on that presentation. Mm-hmm. That's a verbal kudo. Now, when they start painting you as incompetent, mm-hmm. you know, you don't have anything tangible to right. say that you said on this date and this time that, you know, I was doing a great job. I did this. Mm-hmm. So what she would do is she would convert anything that was verbal into something written. So she would run back to her desk and she would open up her email. In the subject, she would put thank you. Mm-hmm. And then she would say, you know, dear Jacqueline, mm-hmm. it was so great seeing you today. Thank you for the compliment you gave me in our meeting mm-hmm. at this time today when you said I did an excellent job on the presentation.
Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And so she would send that email to them. Now, the person receiving that email, they will either just ignore it mm-hmm. or they'll respond back and say, no problem. You know, you did a great job. But even if they don't respond, that's okay because the E in email stands for evidence. Yeah. And now you've got a date stamped document, mm-hmm. date and time stamp that shows on this day mm-hmm. at this time, you said I was doing a great job. And if you didn't dispute that email, mm-hmm. okay, then the onus was on you to dispute it. And this is now valid proof mm-hmm. that I was doing a great job. And she would turn all those little verbal, you know, accolades and mm-hmm. kudos into something tangible. So by the time she's ready to fight, she's got a nice little stack.
Mm-hmm. Now about that. So the first time Ebony actually complains about discrimination, right? And racism in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And she complains about it, but she does it verbally and she does it anonymously.
Yes.
So, which gets her nowhere because her managers find out anyway, right?
Yes.
And then they immediately start, you know, the backlash starts. So what do you have to say to, you know, to people? I mean, of course, Ebony discovered, okay, you know, that didn't work because I said this verbally and I did it anonymously. That's when she decides, of course, to keep the daily logs. And she decides that the E in email, it stands for evidence, all of those things. So what about, though, when, you know, when someone is experiencing racism or any type of discrimination and they want to complain, how long are they supposed to put up with that kind of stuff before they use that evidence.
So here's the thing. The laws were recently changed, okay? So if you remember, in Ebony's situation, she was able to accumulate 5 years worth of documentation, okay? In today's day and age, you absolutely do not want to wait that long before you call out what it is. Mm-hmm. You need to call it out immediately.
Okay.
Immediately. Because now, with the changes that were made in the Supreme Court, you know, you can only fight with 6 months worth of data. Okay. So, the moment you suspect that you are a victim of racism, you need to immediately call it out for what it is. Because if you don't call it out, if you never tell the company that you suspect they are discriminating against you, you will never win. Okay. You must call it out. If you feel like you're being treated differently, you must put that in an email. If you feel like you're being treated differently because you're Black, you must say that in an email. If someone calls you an emotional Black woman, you send them an email and you tell them, you know, in our meeting today, you said I was an emotional Black woman. Can you help me understand why you said that? You need that kind of detail in your evidence.
So never just ignore it.
Never ignore it. And I highly recommend no one ever file anonymously. Okay. Anonymous complaints will not get you anywhere because they can only investigate a little bit without knowing who you are and disclosing who you are. And remember, even though companies say, you know, we have an anonymous hotline, you know, no one's ever going to know, you know, the chances of them knowing that it's you and finding out are really high. And now you're experiencing retaliation.
Right. So let me ask you this. I mean, and I know that people will read the book and they will, you know, they hear other people's experiences when they're dealing with things like this, because some people have a very low tolerance when it comes to discrimination and racism. They're like, you know what? I don't need this. Two fingers. I'm out of here. I mean, the question, why didn't you just quit? Do you think that's a fair question?
Absolutely. It's a fair question. Absolutely. But you have to remember who Ebony was. Ebony was someone who was raised in poverty. She finally gets an opportunity to pull her family out of poverty. She's experiencing racism on a massive level. And she's smart enough to know that, okay, I'm Black. So if I go anywhere else, I'm still going to be Black. So I would rather deal with the devil I know, because I know how they're fighting me right now. I know how they're attacking me, then go to another company and deal with the whole new devil that I know absolutely nothing about. At least I'm aware of what their tactics are, and I can develop a strategy around what I already know.
The devil you know. Okay. Got it. Wow. So let me ask you this. Do you think that everyone who's dealing with systemic racism or other forms of discrimination at work should stay and fight?
So, you know, I always tell people, you put your mental health first. Remember, I was in very dangerous waters, okay? I was on the verge of homicide and suicide. So while I don't agree that you should ever let yourself get to that point, okay? I firmly believe, okay, with every fiber in my being, that if I do leave your organization, and yes, I'll be traumatized, I'll be humiliated, I will hurt, okay? But I'm not leaving empty-handed. Okay, I'm not leaving empty-handed, okay? And when I do leave, I'm going to leave on my terms. And whatever I get from you, I'm going to use that to help me recover before I go back into the lion's den.
Wow. Okay. Now we're talking about, you know, of course, racism and your book, Hush Money, you know, how one woman proved systemic racism in the workplace. Now, we talked about this at the beginning, but can you explain to my listeners, those who do not know, what's the difference between overt and covert racism?
Okay, that is a very good question. So a lot of times when you mention the word covert racism, people are not as familiar with that as they are with overt. And the reason is because if you think about a lot of the books, movies, and TV shows that focus on racism, they tend to focus on the type of racism that you can easily spot, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, you see it and you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that what you're dealing with is racism. Mm-hmm. You know, so an example of that would be someone calling you the N-word in the break room in a public spot where everybody can hear.
Right.
Okay. So that's an example of overt racism. But over the years, racism has morphed into this more hidden way mm-hmm. of attacking you, accomplishing the same goal, but doing it in a way that is more sinister.
Mm-hmm.
It's more nefarious because, number one, it's hidden, mm-hmm. so not everybody can see it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because you can't see it, it's harder to prove. So let me just give you an example of what covert racism in the workplace in modern day today looks like, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's say that you are new in your position. You've been hired to work at a college, okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, with a lot of the college systems, they have multiple campuses. So that means there's going to be duplicate positions.
Right.
At each campus, you've got a receptionist. At each campus, you've got an admissions advisor.
Mm-hmm.
At each campus, you have a student finance advisor. And at each campus, you have directors overseeing each department. So I'm going to take this example right out of my book. I'm going to use the director of student finance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in this college system, two people have been hired. You have a white person mm-hmm. and a black person that have both been hired for the director of student finance job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, in my experience, there is still a wage gap, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But in higher education, those wage gaps are not as glaring as they used to be. They are still there, okay. but they're not as noticeable as they used to be. So you're mm-hmm. both getting fairly decent salaries, okay?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, when the white director is onboarded and they're trained in this new role, mm-hmm. the trainer gives them a very robust training. Okay. They provide them with all the information that they need to be successful in this job. Okay.
Right.
But in addition to the information that's vital to their success, they are giving this white director the right tools. What I mean by that is, you know, he's got this big responsibility. And so he's got a high speed computer, mm-hmm. you know, state of the art computer system with two monitors.
Mm-hmm.
They've got access to high-speed internet. There's a laser printer in his office.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's able to work through his day seamlessly,
yes.
doing his financials, grabbing them off the printer. Everything's working smoothly, no issues.
Mm-hmm.
If he stumbles along the way, there are resources available to help get him back on track.
Mm-hmm.
And if he is feeling some kind of way about something, maybe he's experiencing something that is really bothering him, there are people in leadership positions higher than his
mm-hmm.
that look like him and can identify with what he's going through. So this director is set up for success right out of the gate.
Mm.
Now, the same trainer that set this white director up for success now has to come on over to your campus and train you. But guess what? Not only do they not give you all the information that you need about how to do your job,
mm-hmm.
information that is vital to your success,
mm-hmm.
in my case, they gave me the wrong information about how to do my job.
Wow.
So they wanted me to make mistakes right out of the gate. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you are being set up right out of the gate to make mistakes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't stop there. Remember those wonderful tools he's mm-hmm. got to do his job? Mm-hmm. Okay, state-of-the-art computer, yeah. high-speed internet, printer mm-hmm. in his office. My computer at my campus is older than dirt.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And although the campus has high-speed internet, my computer can't handle it. Okay, wow. So it's freezing all day long. Okay, so you are rebooting your computer, you know, 5, 6, 7 times throughout the day, which is slowing down your productivity. And so you're making mistakes. You're not able to produce the quantity of work that this white director that you're being compared mm-hmm. to because mm-hmm. you're in the same positions
yes.
is doing. And so you are being verbally warned. You are being written up because they're documenting your mistakes and your lack of productivity.
Mm-hmm.
You realize something weird is going on, you know, because you know you're good at your job. You know you can do it, but something's happening. Mm-hmm. You're making these mistakes. So you're trying to find resources available, mm-hmm. and there are no resources that have been made available to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you want to talk to somebody in leadership that can get you a new computer, you yes. know. He's even got a printer in his office. You don't, because they're telling you it's not in the budget. You've got to use the community printer. Mm-hmm. Your documents are always missing. They're paper jammed. They're lost,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so you're trying to figure out, you know, I need help. Can you get me a printer in my office? Can mm-hmm. you get me a faster computer?
Mm-hmm.
But the people in leadership that you're talking to, they think you're making excuses. And so they say the thing that, you know, so there's a phrase that I just cringe every time I hear it. And that phrase goes something like this: well, Jacqueline, you know, maybe you should consider whether this position is the right fit for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because this person over here is able to do the same job and they're not having these issues.
Wow.
And so a lot of our people, they end up losing their jobs or mm-hmm. getting demoted without fully understanding why. And that's how covert racism works, mm-hmm. because you can't really put in a complaint with the government that, you know, they did these things to you. How can you prove that you were set up to fail, that you were trained improperly, right. that, you know, your computer was subpar on purpose,
mm-hmm.
okay? That the printer that they promised you in Q3 is never going to come,
mm-hmm.
okay? That's how covert racism works. And because of that hidden element, it really messes with your mind.
Yes. That's really important. You mentioned that, you know, I teach literature, and we were talking about the effects of slavery yes. on the African-American community, of course, for years mm-hmm. after. And I tell my students that slavery didn't end. So it never really ended. It simply evolved.
So right? Here's what I say, and I agree with you 100%.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that's changed is the location. You went from the field plantation mm-hmm. to the corporate plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're still beholden to someone. And if that person doesn't think that you deserve the position that you're in, they are using covert racism to set you up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there is a way to fight, though. You know, there's a way to fight. And Ebony found that way. And in my book, she shows what she did to turn the tables on these oppressors and not only negotiate her terms for when she was going to leave,
mm-hmm.
but she kept her job, too. She decided, you know, I'm not going to leave just yet. And here's why. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is something you don't know about why she stayed. She said, the chances of you doing this to me again at this new campus you're moving me to mm-hmm. is high. And so when you guys start up this crap, because now you're dealing with a whole new set of people,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to fight you again. And I'm going to get another big payday from you, because I'm not walking away empty-handed.
Mm, there you go. So, I mean, I know that you said that you experienced racial trauma to the point where you wanted to commit suicide, you wanted to commit homicide. How would you say that you're dealing with that trauma today?
So the person that I was that, you know, was in that very dangerous point in my life, I'm light years away from that person, because in sharing Ebony's story, validating what I went through and what my girls went through, and in helping not only Black folks fight back and keep their jobs if they showed so desire, but white folks, you know, white folks who really know racism is wrong. They want to help, but, you know, sometimes Black people don't want their help because they say, you don't understand what we're going through. You don't know what we're experiencing. You know, what my book does is it gives them a way, like I said, to see and feel and smell our circumstances in a real and authentic way. And when they come out of Ebony's five-year journeys, their ideas about what we experience are changed. And when you are someone who was almost broken and you see how many people your pain is helping and that your pain has now become power for thousands of people across the world, there's a healing mechanism in that. And so through sharing my lived experiences, through sharing Ebony's story, I can finally say I'm actually on a path to healing.
Wonderful. You know, and I think that's powerful in and of itself. You didn't say that you are healed. You are on a path to healing.
And I am on a path.
Yes.
There are days where I still cry, you know, when I think about how these folks did me and my children, how they nearly destroyed me had it not been for God's intervention. And it still brings tears to my eyes, but through my pain came purpose and then came power. And and that is strong medicine for healing.
Absolutely. What do you think the biggest lesson you learned from your experience with racism and racial discrimination?
So let me answer that two different ways. The biggest thing that I've learned through my, like I said, nearly 20 year journey is racism is not a one-time thing. My career was derailed five times, five times. And so you encountered it once, you will encounter it again. So it's best to be prepared, you know, hope for the best, but plan for the worst. Go in hoping for the best, but using my book to prepare for the worst, so that when it does start happening to you, you're already in place. Your weapons are already there. You've already collected your evidence. So that was one takeaway. The biggest thing that I can say mistake-wise that I see people making, because I get contacted by people all over the world, but people specifically in the US, one of the biggest mistakes that they make is, you know, they're working in these toxic environments. You know, they're being taken to the brink of their sanity. They're being stripped of all their dignity, all their confidence, and all their strength. The mistake that they make is they go on medical leave. They take a medical leave of absence, FMLA, from work. They take that time off to breathe. And they think when they come back, things are going to be better. And it's not. In fact, because you left, you gave your tormentors the quiet time they needed to finish setting you up. So when you return from that medical leave, you are on the way out, because you're not going to be there much longer before they fire you for not being the right fit or set you up for doing something you know you didn't do. So the way that Ebony used FMLA is she went on FMLA. But then she put a wall of protection, a barrier that was so thick and so high mm-hmm. that when she returned to work, they were afraid
yes.
to immediately fire her.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you want to do. You want to put a wall of protection, because if you use medical leave the right way and you put that wall of protection up that my book shows you how to do,
mm-hmm.
by the time you return to that company from that leave, they will be too afraid to go through with their plans. And it buys you incredible time.
Yes. Yeah. Ebony's tormentors certainly were shaking in their boots.
Yes, they were.
So I know that, yes, you know, you were. you have a birthday coming up. You know, you're going to be 55 double nickels, right?
Yes.
So let me ask you this, and I ask all of my guests this: what are some of the biggest advantages of doing what you do at your age? And what are some challenges?
You know, the biggest advantage is I am no longer in corporate hell.
Mm.
Okay. I absolutely refuse to go back to corporate America. But I am actually teaching. So I speak. People request me to speak and facilitate workshops to show them how they can improve their diversity, equity, and inclusion solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that is the biggest advantage, is not having to go to a 9-to-5 in corporate America.
Mm-hmm.
And because I don't work in corporate America, I can say whatever I want. I can give it to you straight. No chaser.
No chaser.
Yeah. And I don't have to worry about somebody telling me I said something that was against their corporate policy, because
mm-hmm.
I don't really care.
Right. I love it. So what advice do you have for women who are over 40, but they believe their best years are behind them? Now, let me, you know, before you answer that, I want to say all of these things happened for you, like in the past few years. And I'm taken back to that moment when you were standing in front of that vast body of water and you wanted to end it. And I heard Tyler Perry say this the other day on a video as his response to a very prominent person who, you know, unfortunately ended their own life. And he said that he attempted twice, and he looks back on that time and he's so happy that he was not successful, because he would have missed the best part of his life, right? The best part of his life. So that intervention that you received, that phone call from your daughter, I would say it catapulted you into this time in your life. So what advice do you have for women who think, you know, I'm 45 now, I'm 50 now, it's just too late? What advice do you have for them?
I would say that, you know, your life is actually just beginning at this age. You know, I'm going to be 55, but you can take control of your life at any moment. Now, let me just tell you something about the trauma that I went through. I mean, my body just exploded mm-hmm. in weight gain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when I pulled myself out of those environments and I started working on self-care, mm-hmm. okay, and remembering what it felt like to put myself first, okay, I've started losing the weight, mm-hmm. you know, all the things that were hurting before don't hurt anymore. I feel mm-hmm. vibrant.
Mm-hmm.
I can actually tie my own shoes now. I can actually look down and see my shoes. And, you know, those are things that, you know, I feel like I did when I was young. And right now I feel like I'm living my best life at this age. And so I say, at any point in time when you feel like, you know, your best years are behind you, you know, there's an old saying that my mom used to use when she was talking about people's relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it applies here too. You know, mm-hmm. you know, my mom would say, and again, this is talking about somebody's relationship. She would say, you know, some people, you know, they run and they cheat, for example,
mm-hmm.
because they think that the grass is greener on the other side,
mm-hmm.
but they would realize this grass over here could be just as green if they watered it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I'm doing at age 55. I'm watering myself. I'm giving myself that self-love that I've neglected myself for so long because I had so many other priorities that I put in front of myself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're feeling your best years are behind you, you're dealing with brown grass, give it a little water.
I love it. I love it. How can people get in touch with you? I know, you know, I want to mention the book one more time. It's called Hush Money, How One Woman Proved Systemic Racism in Her Workplace and Kept Her Job. It is an amazing book. And there is a sequel.
Yes. The sequel, and I'm sold out on my sequels here, but the sequel is called Hush Money, The Cost of Being Black in Corporate America. Mm-hmm. It literally picks up exactly where this book ended and tells the rest of Ebony's explosive, provocative story about what happened to her when she continued her employment, because remember, she kept her job. Yes. But it also does a deep dive into the other isms that affect Black women, you know, because racism is not the only thing that we deal with in the workplace.
Yes.
You know, so you've got colorism, sexism, narcissism, you've got misogynoir.
So there's, you know, that whole intersectionality, right? Of all of those things. So how can people find you or get in touch with you? You have any social media handles you want to share? Okay.
So I make it a point, Jacqueline, of speaking to absolutely every person who reads my book and reaches out to me to say they want to meet with me. So if someone reads my book and they message me and they say they've read my book, I will send them a link to a Zoom and we will get on a Zoom and talk about it. So the number one place you are guaranteed to reach me and get an immediate response is LinkedIn. I practically live on LinkedIn. I've set up residency on LinkedIn.
People snoozing on LinkedIn. I'm telling you, they are snoozing. School them, please.
Oh, LinkedIn is a diamond. In fact, you know, as a self-published author, it is because of LinkedIn that my book really gained traction and became an international bestseller, being read in countries I didn't even know had Black people. And all of that began with LinkedIn. I'll just be honest, Black people have dominated LinkedIn, because we have found a community of people who are willing to share their lived experiences and their solutions. And so if you're not on LinkedIn, you are missing out, because there are treasure troves and gems found in the lived experiences of these people that they are freely and willingly sharing.
For sure. For sure.
So find me on LinkedIn, message me. You will absolutely get a response. And if you want to buy any of my books, Amazon is going to be the best place, because Amazon, like I said, I self-published. And so on Amazon, I actually have my books discounted. Okay. So you can get them at a reasonable price on Amazon.
Thank you so much for sharing your 40 plus power with us today, Jackie. It's just been a joy. And it's always exciting to meet other authors and get into their heads.
Yes.
All right. It's been a pleasure, Jackie. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Jackie continues to fight for equality in the workplace as an anti-racist consultant. She brings awareness of racial injustice and other forms of discrimination to the forefront. For more information about Jackie and the important work she is doing, you may visit her LinkedIn profile. For more information about the podcast, send inquiries to info@the40plusfiles.com. You can also follow my blog at www.wordyprofessor.com. Until next time, 40 Plus Phenoms, keep on shining. The 40 Plus Files podcast is produced by JJA Entertainment, LLC. The theme song, Women Over 40 Doing Extraordinary Things, was written and performed by Jacqueline J. Andrews and produced by Courtmoney Music.